opened the car door and stood. Silence. I expected to hear shots, but that was not what came first. The first sound was shattering glass, and then I saw Rachel fall out the window. "His car just pulled up," Eshi said. Rachel's hands were still bound behind her back, the duct tape over her mouth. She knew that this was it. Mark would come to the door. They would let him in, this mutant version of Bonnie and Clyde, and then they would shoot them both. Tatiana was already dead. Denise Vanetch was already dead. There was no other way to play this. Eshi and Lydia could not let them survive. Rachel had hoped that Mark would realize this and go to the police. She hoped that he wouldn't show up, but of course, that would not be an option for him. So he was here. He would probably try something foolhardy, or maybe he was still so blinded by hope that he would simply walk into the trap. Either way, Rachel had to stop him. Her only chance was to surprise them. Even then, even if everything fell into place, the best she could realistically hope for was to save Mark. The rest was fool's gold. Time to act. They hadn't bothered to tie her feet. With her hands behind her back and her mouth taped shut, what harm could she do? Trying to run at them would be suicide. She'd make an easy target. And that was what she was counting on. Rachel got to her feet. Lydia turned around and pointed the gun at her. "Sit down." She didn't. And now Lydia had a dilemma. If she fired the gun, Mark would hear it. He would know something was wrong. A stalemate. But it wouldn't last. An idea, a pretty lame idea, came to Rachel. She broke into a run. Lydia would either have to shoot or give chase, or the window. Lydia saw what Rachel was doing, but there was no way to stop her. Rachel lowered her head like a battering ram and dived straight toward the picture window. Lydia raised her gun to shoot. Rachel braced herself. She knew that this would hurt. The glass broke with surprising ease. Rachel flew through it, but what she hadn't counted on was how far off the ground she was. Her hands were still tied behind her back. There was no way to break the fall. She turned to the side and took the impact on her shoulder. Something popped. She felt a stabbing pain run down her leg. A shard of glass stuck out of her thigh. The sound would warn Mark, no question about it. He could be saved. But as Rachel rolled over, dread, deep, heavy dread, hit her next. Yes, she had warned Mark. He had seen her fall out the window. But now, without thinking of the danger, Mark was running toward her.
Vern was crouched on the stairs. He'd been about to make his move when Rachel suddenly stood up. Was she crazy? But no, he realized. She was just a brave lady. After all, she had no idea that he was hiding upstairs. She couldn't just sit there and let Mark walk in on this setup. She wasn't built that way. "Sit down," the woman's voice, the pert thing named Lydia. She started to swing her gun up. Vern panicked. He wasn't in position yet. He wouldn't have a clear shot. But Lydia didn't pull the trigger. Vern watched in amazement as Rachel ran and jumped through the window. Talk about a distraction. Vern moved now. He had heard countless times about how time stands still in moments of extreme violence, that brief seconds can drag so that you can see everything clearly. In reality, that was total bull. When you looked back, when you ran it through your mind in safety and comfort, that's when you imagine it went by slowly. But in the heat of the moment, when he and three buddies had gotten into a firefight with some of Saddam's elite soldiers, time had actually sped up. That was what was happening here. Vern spun around the corner. "Drop it!" The big man had his gun aimed at the window where Rachel had fallen out. There was no time to call out another warning. Vern fired twice. Heshy went down. Lydia screamed. Vern ducked into a roll and disappeared behind the couch. Lydia screamed again. "Heshy!" Vern peered out, expecting to see Lydia aiming the gun at him. But that wasn't the case. She ditched the weapon. Still crying out, Lydia dropped to her knees and gently cradled Heshy's head. "No, don't die. Please, Heshy, please don't leave me." Vern kicked her gun away. He kept his pointed at Lydia. Her voice was low now, soft and motherly. "Please, Heshy, please don't die. Oh, God, please don't leave me." Heshy said, "I never will." Lydia looked at Vern, her eyes pleading. He didn't bother calling 911. He could hear the sirens now. Heshy grabbed Lydia's hand. "You know what you have to do," he said. "No," she said, her voice small. "Lydia, we planned for this. You're not going to die." Heshy closed his eyes. His breathing was labored. "The world will think you were a monster," she said. "I only care what you think. Promise me, Lydia."
"You're going to be fine."
"Promise me." Lydia shook her head. The tears were flowing freely now.
"I can't do it."
"You can." Heshy managed a final smile. "You're a great actress. Remember?"
"I love you," she said.
But his eyes were closed. Lydia kept sobbing. She kept pleading with him not to leave her. The sirens came closer. Vern stood away. The police arrived. When they came inside, they stood around her in a circle. Lydia suddenly lifted her head off Heshy's chest.
"Thank God," she said to them,
and the tears started rolling again.
"My nightmare is finally over."
Rachel was rushed to the hospital. I wanted to follow, but the police had other ideas. I spoke to Zia. I asked her to look in on Rachel for me. The police questioned us for hours. They questioned Vern, Katerina, and me separately, and then together. I think they believed us. Lenny was there. Regan and Tickner showed up, but it took some time. They'd been going through Picard's files per Lenny's phone call. Regan took the lead with me. "Long day. I'm Mark." I sat across from him. "Do I look in the mood for chit-chat, detective?" "The woman goes by the name Lydia Davis. Her real name is Larissa Dane." I made a face. "Why does that name sound familiar?" "She was a child actor." "Trixie," I said, remembering. "On Family Laughs." "Yep. That's her. Or at least that's what she says. Anyway, she claims this guy, we only know him as Heshy, kept her locked up and abused her. She said he forced her to do things. Your friend Vern thinks it's all a scam, but that's not important right now. She claims that she doesn't know anything about your daughter.
How can that be?
She says they were just hired hands. That Picard came to Heshey with a scheme about asking for ransom for a kid they hadn't kidnapped. Heshey loved the idea. A lot of money. And since they didn't really have the kid, there was almost no risk. She says they had nothing to do with the shooting at my house.
That's right.
I looked at Lenny. He saw the problem, too.
But they had my gun. The one they used on Katerina's brother.
Yeah, we know. She claims that Picard gave it to Heshey to set you up. Heshey shot Pavel and planted the gun so you and Rachel would take the fall. How did they get Tara's hair for the ransom drop? How did they get her clothes? According to Ms. Dane, Picard provided them. I shook my head. So Picard was the one who kidnapped Tara? She claims not to know. How about my sister? How did she get involved? Again, she claims it was Picard. He gave them Stacy's name as a fall guy. Heshey gave Stacy the money and told her to cash it at a bank. Then he killed her. I looked over at Tickner, then back at Regan.
It doesn't add up.
We're still working on it. Lenny said, I have a question. Why did they come back after a year and a half and try it again? Ms. Dane claims not to know for sure, but she suspects it was simple greed. She says Picard called and asked if Heshey would want to make another million. He said yes. Going through Picard's records, he was clearly in financial trouble. We think she's right. Picard simply decided to take another bite of the apple. I rubbed my face. My ribs began to ache.
Did you find Picard's adoption records?
Regan glanced at Tickner.
Not yet.
How can that be?
Look, we just got on this. We'll find them.
We're going to check every adoption he's ever made, especially anything involving a female 18 months ago. If Picard had Tara adopted, we'll find out. I shook my head again. What is it, Mark? That doesn't make any sense. The guy has a decent thing going with his adoption scam. Why shoot me and Monica and up the ante to kidnapping and murder?
We don't know, Regan said.
I think we can all agree that there's more to the story. But the truth is, the most likely scenario right now is that your sister and an accomplice shot you and Monica and took the baby. She then brought it to Picard. I closed my eyes and replayed it in my head. Could Stacy have really done that? Could she have broken into my house and shot me? I still couldn't make myself believe. And then I thought of something. Why hadn't I heard the window break? More than that, before I was shot, why hadn't I heard anything? A window break. A doorbell. Heck, a door opening. Why hadn't I heard any of that? The answer, according to Regan, had been that I was blocking. But now I saw that wasn't it. The granola bar, I said. Pardon me. I turned to him. Your theory is that I'm forgetting something, right? Stacy and her accomplice either broke the window or, I don't know, rang the doorbell. I would have heard either one of those. But I didn't. I remember eating my granola bar and then going down.
Right. But see, I was pretty specific. I had the granola bar in my hand. When you found me, it was on the floor. How much had been eaten?
Maybe a bite or two, Tickner said. Then your amnesia theory is wrong. I was standing over the sink, eating the granola bar. I remember that. When you found me, that's what I was doing. There is no time unaccounted for. And if it was my sister, why would she strip Monica, for Christ's sake? I stopped. Lenny said, Mark, did you love her? I stared straight ahead. You know who shot you, don't you, Mark? Dina Levinsky. I thought about her bizarre visits to the house she'd grown up in. I thought about the two guns, one being mine. I thought about the CD-ROM hidden in the basement in the spot Dina had told me about. I thought about those pictures taken in front of the hospital. I thought about what Edgar said about Monica seeing a psychiatrist. And then an awful thought. One so terrible I might indeed have suppressed it began to surface. Chapter 42. I feigned illness and excused myself. I went to the bathroom and dialed Edgar's phone number. My father-in-law himself answered, which surprised me a bit. Hello? You said Monica was seeing a psychiatrist? Mark. Is that you? Edgar cleared his throat. I just heard from the police. Those pissant fools had me convinced that you were behind all this. I don't have time for that now. I'm still trying to find Tara. What do you need? Edgar asked. Did you ever find out the name of her psychiatrist? No. I thought about it. Is Carson there? Yes. Put him on. There was a brief pause. I tapped my foot. Uncle Carson's rich voice came over the line. Mark, you knew about those pictures, didn't you? He didn't reply. I checked our accounts. The money didn't come from us. You paid for the private detective. It had nothing to do with the shooting or kidnapping, Carson said. I think it did. Monica told you the name of her psychiatrist, didn't she? What was it? Again, he did not reply. I'm trying to find out what happened to Tara. She only saw him twice, Carson said. How can he help you? He can't. His name can. What? Just tell me yes or no. Was his name Stanley Radio? I could hear him breathing. Carson, I already spoke to him. He knows nothing. But I had already hung up. Carson wouldn't say any more. But Dina Levinsky might. I asked Regan and Tickner if I was under arrest. They said no. I asked Vern if I could still borrow the Camaro. No problemo, Vern said. Then squinting, he added, Do you need my help? I shook my head. You and Katerina are out of this now. It's over for you. I'm still here if you need me. I don't. Go home, Vern. He surprised me with a big hug then. Katerina kissed my cheek. I let go and watched them drive off in the pickup. I headed toward the city. There was heavy traffic at the Lincoln Tunnel. It took me over an hour to get through the tolls. That gave me time to make some phone calls. I learned that Dina Levinsky shared an apartment in Greenwich Village with a friend. 20 minutes later, I knocked on her door. When Eleanor Russell returned from lunch, there was a plain manila envelope on her chair. It was addressed to her boss, Lenny Marcus, and marked personal and confidential. Eleanor had worked with Lenny for 8 years. She loved him dearly. Having no family of her own, she and her husband Saul, who had died 3 years before, had never been blessed with children. She had become something of a surrogate grandmother to the Marcuses. Eleanor even had photographs of Lenny's wife Cheryl and their 4 children on her desk. She studied the envelope and frowned. How had it gotten here? She peeked into Lenny's office. He looked so harried. That was because Lenny had just returned from a homicide scene. The case involving his best friend, Dr. Mark Seidman, had exploded back into the headlines. Normally, Eleanor would not bother Lenny at a time like this. But the return address... Well, she thought he should see it for himself. Lenny was on the phone. He saw her enter and put his hand over the receiver. I'm kind of busy, he said. This came for you. Eleanor handed him the envelope. Lenny almost ignored it. Then Eleanor watched as he spotted the return address. He turned it over, then back again. The return address simply read, "From a friend of Stacy Seidman." Lenny put down the phone and tore open the envelope. I don't think Dina Levinsky was surprised to see me. She let me in without a word. The walls were blanketed with her paintings. Many hung at odd angles. The effect was dizzying, giving the entire apartment a Salvador Dali feel. We sat in the kitchen. Dina offered to make tea. I said no. She put her hands on the table. I could see that her fingernails were bitten down past the cuticle. Had they been that way at my house? She seemed different now. Sadder, somehow. Her hair was straighter. Her eyes were downcast. It was as if she was transforming back to the pitiful girl I had known in elementary school. You found the pictures? She asked. Yes. Dina closed her eyes. I should have never led you to them. Why did you? I lied to you before. I nodded. I'm not married. I don't enjoy sex. I do have troubles with relationships. She shrugged. I even have problems with telling the truth. Dina tried to smile. I tried to smile back. In therapy, we're taught to confront our fears. The only way to do that is to let the truth in, no matter how much it hurts. But see, I wasn't even sure what the truth was. So I tried to lead you there. You were back in the house before the night I saw you, weren't you? She nodded. And that's how you met Monica. Yes. I kept going. You two became friends. We had something in common. That being? Dina looked up at me, and I saw the pain. Abuse? I said. She nodded. Edgar sexually abused her? No. Not Edgar. Her mother. And it wasn't sexual. It was more physical and emotional. The woman was very ill.
You knew that, right?
I guess I did, I said. Monica needed help. So you introduced her to your therapist?
I tried.
I mean, I set up an appointment for her with Dr. Radio, but it didn't work out.
How come?
Monica was not the sort of woman who believed in therapy. She thought that she could best handle her own problems.
I nodded. I knew.
At the house, I said, you asked me if I loved Monica.
Yes.
Why?
She thought you didn't.
Dina put her finger in her mouth, searching for a sliver of nail to bite. There was none. Of course, she thought herself unworthy of love, like me. But there was a difference.
What was that?
Monica felt that there was one person who could love her forever.
I knew the answer here.
Tara.
Yes.
She trapped you, Mark. You probably realize that. It wasn't an accident. She wanted to get pregnant.
Sadly, I was not surprised. Again, I tried, as in surgery, to put the pieces together.
So Monica believed that I no longer loved her. She was afraid I wanted a divorce. She was troubled. She was crying at night.
I paused. I was saying this as much for my benefit as Dina's. I didn't want to keep following this train of thought, but there was no way to stop me.
She's fragile. Her mind is frayed. And then she hears that phone message from Rachel.
That's your ex-girlfriend?
Yes.
You still keep her picture in your desk drawer.
Monica knew about that, too. You keep mementos of her.
I closed my eyes, remembering the Steely Dan CD in Monica's car. College music. Music I had listened to with Rachel. I said, so she hired a private detective to see if I was having an affair. He took those photographs.
Dina nodded.
So now, she has proof. I'm going to leave her for another woman. I'm going to claim she's unstable. I'll say she's an unfit mother. I'm a well-respected doctor, and Rachel has connections with law enforcement. We'd end up with custody of the only thing that really mattered to Monica.
Tara.
Dina rose from the table. She washed out a glass in the sink and then filled it with water. I thought again about what had happened that morning. Why hadn't I heard the window break? Why hadn't I heard the doorbell ring? Why hadn't I heard the intruder enter?
Simple. Because there was no intruder.
Tears filled my eyes.
So what did she do, Dina?
You know, Mark.
I squeezed my eyes shut.
I didn't think she'd really do it, Dina said. I thought she was just acting out, you know? Monica was so despondent. When she asked me if I knew how to get a gun, I thought she wanted to kill herself. I never thought
she would shoot me.
The air was suddenly heavy. Exhaustion overwhelmed me. I was too tired to cry anymore. But there was still more to unearth here. You said She asked you to help her get a gun?
Dina wiped her eyes and nodded. Did you?
No. I wouldn't know how to get one. She said you had a gun at home, but she didn't want something that could trace back. So she went to the only person she knew with seedy enough contacts to help.
I saw it now. My sister.
Yes.
Did Stacy get her a gun?
No, I don't think so.
What makes you say that?
The morning you were both shot, Stacy came to see me. See, Monica and I had come up with the idea of going to see Stacy together. So Monica mentioned me to her. She came and asked what Monica needed a gun for. I didn't tell her because, well, I really wasn't all that sure. Stacy ran out. I was in a panic. I wanted to ask Dr. Radio what to do, but my next session was that afternoon. I figured it could wait.
And then?
I still don't know what happened, Mark. That's the truth. But I know Monica shot you.
How?
I got scared, so I called your house. Monica answered. She was crying. She told me you were dead. She kept saying, "What have I done? What have I done?" And then suddenly she hung up. I called back, but no one answered. I really didn't know what to do. Then the TV had the story. When they said your daughter was missing, I didn't understand. I thought they'd find her right away. But they never did. And I never heard anything about those pictures either. I hoped. I don't know. I hoped leading you to those photographs might shed some light on what really happened. Not so much for the two of you, but for your daughter.
Why did you wait so long? Her eyes closed, and for a moment I thought that she might be praying.
I had a bad spell, Mark. 2 weeks after you were shot, I was hospitalized with a breakdown. The truth is, I was so far gone, I forgot about it. Or maybe I wanted to forget, I don't know.
My cell phone rang. It was Lenny. I picked it up.
Where are you?
He asked.
With Dina Levinsky.
Get over to Newark Airport, Terminal C, now.
What's going on?
I think, Lenny said. Then he slowed down, caught his breath.
I think I may know where we can find Tara.
Chapter 43. By the time I arrived at Terminal C, Lenny was already standing by the Continental check-in desk. It was 6 o'clock at night now. The airport was jammed with the weary. He handed me the anonymous note that had been found in his office. It read, Abe and Lorraine Tansmore, 26 Marsh Lane, Hanley Hills, Missouri. That was it. Just the address. Nothing else.
It's a suburb near St. Louis, Lenny explained. I did some research already.
I just kept staring down at the name and address.
Mark?
I looked up at him.
The Tansmores adopted a daughter 18 months ago. She was 6 months old when they got her. Behind him, a Continental Service rep said, Next, please. A woman pushed past me. She might have said, Excuse me, but I'm not sure.
I have us booked on the next flight to St. Louis. We're leaving in an hour. When we reached the departure gate, I told him about my meeting with Dina Levinsky. We sat, as we often do, next to each other, facing out. When I finished, he said, "You have a theory now." "I do." We watched a plane take off. An old couple sitting across from us shared a tin of Pringles. I'm a cynic. I know that. I hold no illusions about drug addicts. If anything, I overestimate their depravity. And that, I think, is what I did here. How do you figure? Stacy wouldn't shoot me. She wouldn't shoot Monica. And she would never hurt her niece. She was an addict. But she still loved me. "I think," Lenny said, "that you're right." I look back. I was so wrapped up in my own world that I never saw. I shook my head. Now was not the time for this. "Monica was desperate," I said. "She couldn't get a gun, and maybe," she decided, "she didn't have to." "She used yours," Lenny said. "Yes." "And then?" Stacy must have guessed what was up. She ran to the house. She saw what Monica had done. I don't know how it played exactly. Maybe Monica tried to shoot her, too. That could explain the bullet hole near the stairs. Or maybe Stacy just reacted. She loved me. I was lying there. She probably thought I was dead. So I don't know, but either way, Stacy came armed, and she shot Monica. The gate attendant announced that the flight would soon be boarding, but those with special needs or one-pass gold and platinum members could board now. "You said on the phone that Stacy knew Picard?" Lenny nodded. "She mentioned him, yeah." Again, I'm not sure how it played exactly. But think about it. I'm dead. Monica is dead. And Stacy is probably freaking out. Tara is crying. Stacy can't just leave her. So she takes Tara with her. Later she realizes that she can't raise a kid on her own. She's too messed up. So she turns her over to Picard and tells him to find her a good family. Or if I want to be cynical, maybe she gives Tara over for the money. We'll never know. Lenny was nodding. From there, well, we just follow what we already learned. Picard decides to rake in extra money by pretending it was a kidnapping. He hires those two lunatics. Picard would be able to get hair samples, for example. He double-crossed Stacy. He set her up to take the fall. I saw something cross Lenny's face. "What?" "Nothing," he said. "They called our row." Lenny stood. "Let's board." The flight was delayed. We didn't arrive in St. Louis until past midnight, local time. It was too late to do anything tonight. Lenny booked us a room at the airport Marriott. I bought clothes at their all-night boutique. When we got to the room, I took a very long, very hot shower. We settled in and stared at the ceiling. In the morning, I called the hospital to check on Rachel. She was still sleeping. Zia was in her room. She assured me that Rachel was doing fine. Lenny and I tried to eat the hotel's buffet breakfast. Nothing would stay down. A rental car was waiting for us. Lenny had gotten directions to Hanley Hills from the desk clerk. I don't remember what we saw on the drive. Aside from the arch in the distance, there was nothing distinct. The United States has a strip mall sameness about it now. It's easy to criticize that. I often do. But maybe the appeal is that we all like what we already know. We claim to embrace change. But in the end, especially in these times, what truly draws us is the familiar. When we reached the town limits, I felt a tingling in my legs. "What do we do here, Lenny?" He had no answer. "Do I just knock on the door and say, 'Excuse me, I think that's my daughter?'" "We could call the police," he said. "Let them handle it." But I didn't know how that would play out. We were so close now. I told him to keep on driving. We made a right onto Marsh Lane. I was shaking now. Lenny tried to give me a buck-up look, but his face was pale, too. The street was more modest than I'd expected. I had assumed that all of Bacard's clients were wealthy. That was clearly not the case with this couple. "Abe Tansmore works as a schoolteacher," Lenny said, reading my thoughts as usual. "Sixth grade. Lorraine Tansmore works for a daycare center 3 days a week. They're both 39 years old. They've been married for 17 years. Up ahead, I saw a house with a cherry sign that read 26, the Tansmores. It was a small, one-level, what I think they called bungalow style. The rest of the houses on the block seemed tired. This one did not. The paint glistened like a smile. There were lots of clusters of color, of flowers and shrubs, all trimly laid out and perfectly pruned. I could see a welcome mat. A low picket fence encircled the front yard. A station wagon, a Volvo model from several years back, sat in the driveway. There was a tricycle, too, and one of those bright-hued plastic big wheels. And there was a woman outside. Lenny pulled over in front of an empty lot. I barely noticed. The woman was in the flower beds on her knees. She was working a small digging spade. Her hair was tied back with a red bandana. Every few digs, she would wipe her forehead with her sleeve. "You say she works at a daycare center?" "3 days a week. The daughter goes with her." "What do they call the daughter?" "Natasha." I nodded. I don't know why. We waited. The woman, this Lorraine, worked hard, but I could see she enjoyed it. There was a serenity about her. I opened the car window. I could hear her whistling to herself. I don't know how many minutes passed. A neighbor walked by. Lorraine rose and greeted her. The neighbor gestured toward the garden. Lorraine smiled. She wasn't a beautiful woman, but she had a great smile. The neighbor left. Lorraine waved goodbye and turned back to her garden. The front door opened. I saw Abe. He was a tall man, thin and wiry, slightly balding. He had a neatly trimmed beard. Lorraine stood and looked over at him. She gave him a small wave. And then Tara ran outside. The air around us stopped. I felt my insides shut down. Next to me, Lenny stiffened and muttered, "Oh, my God." For the last 18 months, I had never really believed that this moment was possible. What I had done instead was convince myself. No, trick myself into believing that maybe, somehow, Tara was still alive and okay. But my subconscious knew it was only a self-delusion. It winked at me. It nudged me in my sleep. It whispered the obvious truth, that I would never see my daughter again. But it was my daughter. She was alive. I was surprised at how little Tara had changed.
Oh, she'd grown, of course. She was able to stand. She was even able, as I now saw, to run. But her face...
There was no mistake. No being blinded by hope. It was Tara. It was my little girl. With a huge smile, Tara ran with total abandon toward Lorraine. Lorraine bent low, her face lighting up in that celestial way only a mother's can. She swept my child into her arms. Now I could hear the melodious sound of Tara's laughter. The sound pierced my heart. Tears streamed down my face. Lenny put a hand on my arm. I could hear him sniffling. I saw the husband, this Abe, walk toward them. He was smiling too. For several hours I watched them in their small, perfect yard. I saw Lorraine patiently point out the flowers, explaining what each one was. I saw Abe give her a horsey ride on his back. I saw Lorraine teach her how to pat the dirt down with her hand. Another couple dropped by. They had a little girl about Tara's age. Abe and the other father pushed the girls on the metal swing set in the backyard. Their giggles pounded in my ears. Eventually, they all went inside. Abe and Lorraine were the last to disappear. They walked through the door with their arms around each other. Lenny turned to me. I let my head drop back. I had hoped that today would be the end of my journey. But it wasn't. After a while, I said, "Let's go." Chapter 44. When we got back to the airport Marriott, I told Lenny to go home. He said he would stay. I told him that I could handle this on my own, that I wanted to handle this on my own. He reluctantly agreed. I called Rachel. She was doing well. I told her what had happened. "Call Harold Fisher," I said. "Ask him to do a thorough background check on Abe and Lorraine Tansmore. I want to know if there's something there." "Okay," she said softly. "I wish I could be there." "Me too." I sat on my bed. My head dropped into my hands. I don't think I cried. I don't know what I felt anymore. It was over. I had learned as much as I would. When Rachel called back 2 hours later, nothing she told me was a surprise. Abe and Lorraine were solid citizens. Abe was the first person in his family to graduate college. He had two younger sisters who lived in the area. Both had three children. He had met Lorraine during their freshman year at Washington University in St. Louis. Night fell. I stood and looked in the mirror. My wife had tried to kill me. Yes, she was unstable. I knew that now. Hell, I probably knew it then. I didn't much care, I guess. When a child's face breaks, I put it back together. I can do miracles in the surgical room. But my own family fell apart, and I did nothing but watch. I thought now about what it meant to be a father. I loved my daughter. I know that. But when I saw Abe today, when I see Lenny coaching soccer, I wonder... I wonder about my fitness. I wonder about my commitment. And I wonder if I am worthy.
Or do I already know the answer? I wanted so badly to have my little girl back with me. I also wanted so badly for this not to be about me or my wants. Tara had looked so damn happy. It was midnight now. I looked at myself in the mirror again. What if leaving this alone, letting her stay with Abe and Lorraine, was the right thing? Was I really brave enough, strong enough, to walk away? I kept staring in the mirror, challenging myself. Was I? I lay back. I think I fell asleep. A knock on the door startled me awake. I glanced at the digital clock next to my bed. It read 5:19 a.m. I'm sleeping, I said. Dr. Seidman? It was a male voice. Dr. Seidman, my name is Abe Tansmore. I opened the door. He was handsome up close, in a sort of James Taylor way. He wore jeans and a tan shirt. I looked at his eyes. They were blue, but tinged with red. So, I knew, were mine. For a long time, we just stared at one another. I tried to speak, but I couldn't. I stepped back and let him in. Your lawyer stopped by. Abe stopped, swallowed hard. He told us the whole story. Lorraine and I stayed up all night. We talked it out. We cried a lot. But I think we knew right from the get-go that there was only one decision here. Abe Tansmore was trying to hold on, but he was losing it now. He closed his eyes. We have to give you your daughter back. I didn't know what to say. I shook my head. We have to do what's best for her. That's what I'm doing, Dr. Seidman. Call me Mark. Please. It was a dumb thing to say. I know that. But I wasn't ready for this. If you're worried about a long, drawn-out court case, Lenny shouldn't have... No, that's not it. We stood there a little longer. I pointed toward the chair in the room. He shook his head. Then he looked at me. All night. I've been trying to imagine your pain. I don't think I can. I think there are places a man just can't get to without experience. Maybe this is one of them. But your pain, awful as it must be, that's not why Lorraine and I came to this decision. And it's not because we blame ourselves either. In hindsight, maybe we should have wondered what was going on. We went to Mr. Bacard. But the fees would have added up to over $100,000. I'm not a rich man. I couldn't afford that. Then a few weeks later, Mr. Bacard calls us. He said he had a baby that needed immediate placing. She wasn't a newborn, he said. The mother had just abandoned her. We knew something was not quite right, but he said that if we wanted this, we'd have to go in, no questions asked. He looked off then. I watched his face. I think deep down, maybe we always knew. We just couldn't face it. But that's not the reason we came to this decision either. I swallowed. What then?
His eyes drifted toward mine. You can't do the wrong thing for the right reason. I must have looked confused. If Lorraine and I don't do this, we're not fit to raise her. We want Natasha to be happy. We want her to be a good person. You might be the best ones to make that happen. He shook his head. That's not how it works. We don't give children to whatever parents would be best to raise them. You and I can't make that judgment. You don't know how hard this is for us. Or maybe you do. I turned away. I caught my reflection in the mirror. Just for a second. Less, maybe. But it was enough. I saw the man I was. I saw the man I wanted to be. I turned to him and said, I want us both to raise her. He was stunned. So was I. I'm not sure I understand, he said. Neither do I. But that's what we're going to do. How? I don't know. Abe shook his head. It can't work. You know that. No, Abe, I don't know that. I came here to bring my daughter home. And I find that maybe she already is. Is it right for me to rip her away from that? I want you both in her life. I'm not saying it'll be easy. But kids are raised by single parents, by step-parents in foster homes. There are divorces and separations and who knows what. We all love this little girl. We'll make it work. I saw the hope return to the man's thin face. He couldn't speak for a few seconds. Then he said, Lorraine is in the lobby. Can I go talk to her? Of course. It didn't take long. There was a knock on my door. When I opened it, Lorraine threw her arms around me. I hugged her back, this woman I had never met. Her hair smelled of strawberry. Behind her, Abe came into the room. Tara was sleeping in his arms. Lorraine let go of me and moved away. Abe stepped closer. He handed me my daughter carefully. I held her, and my heart burst into flame. Tara began to stir. She started to fuss. I still held her. I rocked her back and forth and made shushing sounds. And soon she settled on me and fell back to sleep. Chapter 45. It started to all go wrong again when I looked at the calendar. The human brain is amazing. It is a curious mix of electricity and chemicals. It is, in effect, pure science. We understand more about the workings of the great cosmos than we do about the curious circuitry of the cerebrum, cerebellum, hypothalamus, medulla oblongata, and all the rest. And like any tricky compound, we are never sure how it will react to a certain catalyst. There were several things that gave me reason to pause. There was the question of leaks. Rachel and I had thought that someone in either the FBI or police department had told Bacard and his people what was happening. But that never fit in with my theory about Stacy shooting Monica. There was the fact that Monica was found with no clothes on.
I think I understood why now, but the thing is...